Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talk House Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talk House Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. This week's episode features a pair of legends from the alt country or country or no depression or Americana or whatever you want to call it worlds. You pick. It's Jay Farrar of Sunvolt, along with singer-songwriter and many other things, Steve Earle. Jay Farrar started his career as part of the seminal band Uncle Tupelo alongside another noted songwriter and frequent Talk House guest, Jeff Tweedy. After their split, Tweedy went on to form Wilco, while Farrar formed Sunvolt, which has since released an impressive catalog. Their 10th and latest album was recorded during pandemic downtime, and you can hear it in the deliberateness of the songs. It's called Electro Melodier, and here's a little taste of the song Reverie.
When you fade into a melody, your mind is lost in reverie. You can feel the earth and touch the sky. Don't mind the shade when there's inner light. What you do.
Now, Steve Earle is one of those guys who makes you feel lazy. He's not only an incredibly accomplished singer and songwriter with literally dozens of albums to his credit, he's also a producer, an actor, most notably on The Wire, a novelist, a Sirius XM DJ, and as you'll hear here, an aspiring TV show creator. His 2020 album, Ghosts of West Virginia, was spun off from an off-Broadway show he worked on, while this year's JT is a tribute to his talented son, Justin Townes Earle, who passed away just last year. As you'll hear, he's got even more projects in the works, including a tribute to singer-songwriter Jerry Jeff Walker. Here's a little bit of Union, God, and Country from 2020's Ghosts of West Virginia.
My dad was a miner. My dad is daddy, too. Union, God, and Country was all they ever knew. They worked from early morning till the evening was so blue. When it struck the mine, they'd walk the line, cause that's just what you do. Born in West Virginia, a miner through and through, Union, God, and Country was all you ever knew.
As you'll hear, Steve Earle loves to chat, while Jay Farrar is a bit more subdued, a fact that these friends acknowledge right off the bat. But they get into a great conversation about their favorite subject, music. What they listened to growing up, the great shows that Earle saw as a kid, and even the time Earle sold some weed to Leslie West of Mountain. Steve talks about missing the whole genesis of alt-country for good reason. He was in jail, but catching up with it, and with Sunvolt in particular. Enjoy.
Good to see you, man. It's been a while.
Last time we saw each other, you were gracious enough to loan me three of your harmonicas.
And you have to know somebody real well to borrow or lend a harmonica. It's one of those things. It's an unsanitary instrument.
It's like sharing a toothbrush. You know, our musical bond has been forged now.
I know, no doubt about it. I occasionally, like when I'm playing small places on a solo tour or something, I play adult nightclubs where people eat sometimes, you know, and I apologize to the whole front row for anything that comes flying out of the harp, you know, while they're eating, because it can happen. There can be particles. It's just one of those things. You do your best, but it's an unsanitary instrument. I guess background-wise, the way we met, I missed Uncle Tupelo entirely, because that was that period of time when I was like, didn't even have a guitar, and I was on the street, and then I was locked up. And so by the time I got out of jail, got clean, you know, and started plugging myself back in, I'd heard there was an Uncle Tupelo and that there was getting ready to be Sunvolt and Wilco. The records weren't out yet.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of other people missed it too. So part of the club.
Yeah. But dude, I always knew who the Burrito Brothers were. I got lucky because of where I live. The Burritos got played on the radio.
Oh, man.
You know, country rock was a thing to me from Jump Street. I mean, a part of it's where I grew up, yeah. You know, and Buck Owens and the Beatles are played on the same radio station where I grew up.
Is that AM or FM?
Yeah. Well, AM. Yeah, it would have been all AM radio at that point. FM radio starts about the time I'm like in junior high school, the first FM station in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And AM's where I heard Beatles and Buck Owens on the same station. FM's where I heard the Flying Burrito Brothers for the first time. And that was the local, what do they call it, progressive radio station, which actually it began.
And that was in Houston area? Or
San Antonio.
San Antonio.
That's actually where I grew up. You know, so I got lucky. I heard the Burrito Brothers. I heard those Birds records. You know, I knew about that stuff.
I think it does have to do with where you grew up. Yeah, with, for me, you know, it would have been Kansas and J.D. Blackfoot and stuff like that.
Right, right.
But the AM radio was still pretty good. With they could play Badfinger and they would play, you know, Neil Young and stuff like that.
Yeah, so. The stuff that was on FM radio, the stuff that became the hits got played on AM radio too. They played the edited version of Enigata de Vida. You know,
what kind of rock bands did you go out to see when you were a teenager?
I was lucky because San Antonio was one of those places where all these tourists came through, and there were three or four bands on a tour. So I saw Humble Pie three or four times. The bands that were on the middle of the bill, you got to see a lot.
Yeah.
I saw Humble Pie a lot. I saw the original Fleetwood Mac a lot. I saw Savoy Brown a lot. I saw Wishbone Ash. I saw Leslie West, a bag of pot, through the back door of the Municipal Auditorium in San Antonio when I was 15 years old. So I listened to rock and roll.
Not many people can say that.
Yeah, no, I know. And we had a conversation about that at Matt Umanoff's guitars years later because, you know, he, until he passed away, he would pop. I loved Mountain. I loved that band. And I've recently sort of revisited that, sort of a chain of events. Like I moved to New York and then I had a house in Woodstock for a while until this last divorce. It kind of went away in that. And, but my neighbors were John Sebastian and, you know, Levon Helm, John Henry's one of a handful of kids that can say he got his first drum kit from Levon Helm for Christmas, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But Sebastian was a big deal to me when I was a kid. And so I hung out with him and he came to my house and played my guitars and collected vicariously through me because Catherine had put her foot down and wouldn't let him have any more guitars in the house. And I kept buying them. And I always knew Felix Pappalardi was important, but Pappalardi, who produced not only those Mountain records, he was the bass player and one of the singers in Mountain and wrote a lot of that stuff, but he also produced the first two Cream records. You know, he was a really important guy around music in New York, and they were really, really close friends. And so I just sort of recently, because of that, kind of lined up and I got out those first two Mountain records, or I downloaded them, put them on my phone a couple of Christmases ago and rode around and listened to them.
The Mountain section of my record collection is nil.
They're worth checking out. But I ended up, my dad just would not let me have an electric guitar. And that I became a folky by default. I sang in a few rock bands, but you kind of had to own a PA system to get that gig in a high school rock band. The guy that owned the PA got to be the singer. And I did it in a couple of bands. I played bass in one. But I didn't really have that equipment either. My dad wouldn't let me have an electric guitar, not because he hated electric guitar, because there were five kids and there wasn't money and there wasn't room and space for the sound. So I had an acoustic guitar. So I started gravitating towards stuff that sounded like my guitar. So I was listening to the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks, but I learned to play Mother's Little Helper and A Well-Respected Man and, you know, Rocky Raccoon and chill, you know, stuff that sounded like my guitar.
Kinks, you know, one thing we could talk about is probably the Stones. I think I saw that you mentioned one time that your favorite period of Stones you're most influenced by was the mid-60s, like those mid-60s albums.
Absolutely, yeah.
For me, I kind of run with the crowd, you know, like 1968, Beggar's Banquet through 1976.
Well, Beggar's Banquet is one of my records. I mean, it's like Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed. And it doesn't end there. I love the riff rock Stones too, but so the acoustic guitars and, you know, to hear the acoustic stuff and the later stuff, it was the one or two Keith tracks where you heard a lot of acoustic guitars. Earlier on, acoustics were much more prominent and I could make my guitar sound like that. I just gravitated towards what I could emulate, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Keith.
Yeah. I learned to play from records. You know, I learned from my uncle for a few years who was 5 years older than me that lived in our house when he was a senior in high school for a year, gave me my first guitar and gave me some bad stuff too.
You mean by bad stuff?
Like drugs, you know.
Okay.
So,
synthesizer?
No, not synthesizer. I don't have an aversion to any instrument in the right hands when it gets right down to it. There's a lot of synthesizers on my records in the 80s, man. I just used them a little differently than some people did. The bagpipe on the front of Copperhead Road is a Rhodes Chroma patch that my keyboard player built from scratch. And it's pretty convincing, actually.
No, they're useful instruments now. I just say that because if they get in the wrong hands.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to do it. Use it as a utility thing. And also, there's been some stuff that's just unapologetic synthesizer music that was just you know, by very smart people that I thought was kind of cool too. I'm lucky. I don't have any real prejudices about a particular kind of music. I just sort of, I think it's about songs.
Yeah.
I think that's the songs that stick with everybody. I always wondered about that with that wave. There's always been, they changed the name of it. It was country rock. I'm okay with that term. In Austin, they were saying progressive country. There was a radio station with the call letters K-O-K-E that played progressive country in the 70s.
And K-O-K-E.
Nice. Yeah, K-O-K-E. Yeah, it was a thing in Austin. But turquoise and cocaine, those were the two minerals. But by the time I got out of jail and heard about you guys, everybody was talking about alt country. Mm-hmm. And now they're calling it Americana.
Yeah, you've probably heard the labels recycled over a few more times than I have,
that's just because there's 8 tracks on my first record. That's just because I'm old, you know. It's one of those things. I've seen a whole format CDs come and then go away, you know, just because I didn't die. That's kind of basically it.
That's the way we do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I wondered about you guys, like what. There was something going on in the Midwest, you know, where you grew up. Mm-hmm. And a little earlier than you, like in the 80s, when I had a country music deal, which was kind of a separate thing, but some of the same guys that were listening to the Long Riders and bands like that were going on the West Coast. And the Long Riders got identified with sort of a neo-psychedelic movement, but they were a country rock band and a good one, you know, really good one. So what were you listening to that made you want to do something that was, you know, heavily, heavily influenced by country music and folk music?
I mean, I got most of those influences from both of my parents. You know, my father he played guitar and he played Hank Williams songs. You know, that was
right.
Something that resonated. And my mom was more into the folk side of things. She knew the Dillards. You know, both of my folks came from the Ozarks. So, you know, the Dillards were kind of big in their world.
Wow.
And wow. You know, she knew Rodney and Doug Dillard. So those records were around the house.
So you were hearing bluegrass as well when you were growing up to some degree.
Yeah.
I remember being on a bus in St. Louis and you came to the show. You know, I told you that I was going to make a bluegrass record. I don't think you believed me. And you got on and I played you the first 4 tracks from The Mountain. And you said, You did it. You know, you seem genuinely surprised because I made it with the Del McCurry band. You know, I just,
yeah.
Doug Dillard was one of the very, who was in Nashville when I got there. You know, it was just him by that time. And he hung around at the station and he's one of the very first people I met. And he just, for some reason, long before I made a record or anybody recorded my songs, he sort of liked me and would talk to me and was a huge help.
Nice.
And the Dillards are a big deal to me. Those records are amazing.
There's part of the continuum right there, I guess. Doug Dillard brings us together. But where was the first time that we met? Was it actually just doing a show together?
I think maybe we were on the same bill at like, what was that place in Nashville? Something, so it was a number. I think that was the very first one. It was the first time I got up and did Windfall with you guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And we started doing it in our encores, you know, so I think that was the first time.
Yep.
And I know how I found out about you guys. I worked with Richard Dodd on I Feel All Right. On 4 of those tracks, Richard produced. And there was some kind of weird thing going on where I don't remember what it was because he was involved with the Wilco record too, but he was involved peripherally with your record because he wasn't supposed to be. His engineer basically had mixed it. So they were working on it there. When I came in to start work on those 4 tracks, I Feel All Right was done in pieces. We started it before I had a record deal. Ray Kennedy and I did, and Richard Bennett did 3 or 4 tracks, and then Richard Dodd did 4 tracks, and then we went back and finished it with Richard Bennett and Ray Kennedy at Ray's place, and I ended up owning part of that studio and working with Ray Kennedy for years and still do to this day, but I don't have the studio anymore because I moved to New York.
That sort of leads to a Lucinda question, I guess. You were the producer of Car Wheels, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was. And it was in those days, Ray was been my engineer all that time. And we sort of produced everything under, you know, producer, engineer. Even my brother was considered to be a member because he was our second there, Patrick. But we called it Twang Trust. And my manager's still pissed off at me because a lot of people don't know I produced that record because the credit is Twang Trust. We were making I Feel All Right. And I've done Loop since we were teenagers, you know, so she had settled in Nashville by that time. The first time I wrote a duet specifically for us to sing called You're Still Standing There. I'd become fascinated with duets and I started writing songs to be duets. So Glue came in to record you know, that song with me. And she just liked the way her voice sounded in our studio. So she had already recorded one version of Car Wheels, and neither she or the label were happy with it. And so we started all over again and re-recorded all of that stuff. And it was tumultuous. It was like, I ended up overseeing a divorce between her and, you know, not, they yeah. weren't married, but they were married musically, you know, right. And it was just, it was one of those things that was in the middle of. I'm really proud to have been part of it.
With your guiding hand, you know, you made a great record there.
Well, it was one of those things. All we ever did there was just try not to get in the way. We had a way yeah. that things sounded.
That's the essence of it all, you know.
It's about songs. And she had a great band. We used her band. John Shambody was still with us in those days. He played bass, and he was her manager at the time. But, you know, Shambody was, I used him on sessions in L.A. when I lived there for a short period of time on a couple of things. Shambody was in Clover, that country rock band that Huey Lewis had, who ended up being the record on My Aim Is True, the first Elvis Costello record. Huh. That's Shambody.
Did not know
those songs. And yeah. And then Donald, her drummer, who passed away. He's gone now too. Was a great drummer. And then Gerf Morlix had been her right hand and guitar player for a long time. And that he's on Car Wheels. He got taken off a lot of it after it left my hands. Mm-hmm. But other people worked on it, and it came back to Ray. We ended up restoring it to pretty much what Ray and I originally recorded before it actually came out. It was went through a couple of record labels, and it was just Danny Goldberg ended up buying it, you know, from American Recordings when he was, he brought it over to another label and put it out. So, and by that time I'd started working with Danny too. So that's how Danny found out about me, really was working on the Lucinda record. That's how I kind of got it. And he's still my manager to this day.
So I was part of that as well.
Yeah. No, I remember that. Yep. That's where the Joe McEwen, Joe McEwen meeting took place. That was an Artemis. It was pretty funny. When I tell people that story that know you and know Joe, their jaws drop. Just the whole image of me sitting there. So I said, boy, you must have been talking a lot. You know, it's and I said, well, I talk a lot. Yeah, that's one of those deals.
Yeah, Joe's a great guy though.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast. We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of Talkhouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than 1 million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. DistroLock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
You know, it's funny. I went back to Warner for one record. Cameron Strang was running Warner, and he signed me there, and then they fired him, and then they dropped me.
The same old record company dance. Yes.
Yeah, it's one of those deals. It's weirder than it's ever been. I don't know what to tell people. Even by the time Justin came along, I didn't know what to tell him about the music business. It had changed so much by then. Now we're in this point where masters are actually worth more than copyrights are now, Jay. And that's something that I really believed I would never see. And it's because of streaming. When you see all these big deals, they're trying to buy everything. They want to buy. I'm selling everything up to now just because they're paying a lot of money for it now. Odds are they won't be paying this much in the time I've got left on the planet. And I'm definitely getting more than I'll collect in royalties.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Just waiting for it to come in. And I can set John Henry up. My youngest son's 11 and he has autism. So his brother Ian will take care of him, and his kids probably will too. But Ian has two kids of his own. So he needs resources to take up the slack because John Henry's going to need a lot of taken care of. So
sure.
It's he communicates. He does not speak though, and he's probably not going to be able to work and make a living. And at the list of sports, I mean, anything can happen, but so far that's our guess, you know. So this will allow me to set things up. And, you know, it's one, and I want to stay in New York because the next chapter for me is music for theater. That's what I've been doing.
So yeah, you actually have done some Broadway. I mean, you've worn a lot of different hats over the years. You know, you're six.
Haven't done Broadway yet, but I've done a couple of plays with music, off-Broadway things. And I'm working on something that's tracked for Broadway right now, which is, it's a musical of Tender Mercies, which I don't know whether you recall that movie.
That sounds familiar.
It was Robert Duvall, and it was... It was Bruce Beresford's first film, and it's set in Central Texas. It's about this kind of washed-up country songwriter and singer, and his songs made his wife famous, and he's kind of been on the skids, and he pops up in this little tiny motel in Central Texas, and this woman takes him in and he gets sober. And then his ex-wife comes through town on a tour and things get interesting. And it's just perfect for me. Horton Foote wrote the screenplay, who also wrote The Trip to Bountiful. And he wrote the screen adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. That's what put him on the map. And he's a great writer. He's gone now. But his daughter, Daisy Foote, has been trying to put together something for a musical for years. And I was in a show called Coal Country that was up at the Public Theater that I was actually performing in. I wrote the songs for. It's about an explosion that happened in a coal mine in West Virginia, almost 12 years ago.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that. Yeah.
That record became Ghosts of West Virginia, which is the record I put out in the middle of the pandemic. So I have a record to tour next summer. I'm going to make a final tribute record. I'm going to complete the set. I probably would have done, if Justin hadn't passed away, I probably would have already done this, but I'm going to complete the set. Guy Towns, I'm going to make a record of Jerry Jeff Walker songs. And
all right, yeah,
we're going to record that in December and it'll come out this summer because theater takes a long time. So I'm going to be concentrating the songwriting on Coal Country for a little while yet to go before we get that show up.
Gotcha. Let's go through the list of all the different hats you've worn over the years. You know, so you're obviously singer, songwriter, musician. You've written novels too, right?
One novel and a collection of short fiction I've published, and I'm working on another novel. So
obviously actor.
Yeah. And that was just David Simon's idea. Yeah. And, you know, the idea was I was supposed to play a redneck recovering addict and it didn't feel like I would have to act. So I took it and I loved David Simon, you know, so I did it. He's a big music fan. So he knew about me. One of my songs had been the theme of a prior project of his called The Corner.
And you're still a DJ, right? You do that?
Yeah, I did that. I've had that show. I started on Air America and I had a show on Air America.
Yeah. I remember that. That was, I showed up for that one time when Chuck D had a show. That blew my mind that you guys had that show. That was incredible.
Yeah, no, we and Chuck D, we had the two music shows and we would get together every once in a while because he was on the panel of one of the political shows as well every day. But he had a musical show and I had a musical show. Mine was mainly about just interviewing people that, you know, mostly, and I gravitated towards doing more about write songs and songwriting. And then by the time Air America ended, Sirius had been making offers for a long time. So I went to Sirius and I've been there ever since.
So you got Broadway's in the works and, so what's left? You know, you're going to fly to space with Bezos?
No, I'm not going to do that. Everybody's doing that shit. You know, that's what I was like. I'll tell you what I'm working on. This closest I'm going to come to, I'm going to time travel. Actually,
yeah.
I'm working on a pilot for a TV show. It started out as a treatment I wrote. I just got the idea from I'm not going to really talk about it right now. There's a TV show based on something else I wrote in the past that is probably going to get made and I'll be a producer on it, but it's not really me writing it, but it got me interested in the process. And I've been around it a lot. I worked with David Simon
right.
And I've been in a couple of shows and I've been in movies. I think the best dramatic writing being done today is arguably being done for television. It's just, it's where the money is. The writers control, like, theater's a really an actor's medium. Film is a director's medium, and the producers in the TV world are writers. That's who runs the showrunners are writers. They come from writing. And I got this idea and I wrote a treatment, and Brian Koppelman, who's been really successful with Billions and some other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He's a big music fan, and we have friends in common. His father actually was a publisher, and his father bought me once, I remember, years ago.
So to speak, gotcha.
Bought me when I was a young boy, but I just showed it to him, and he called me back, and he was in the middle of trying to get this last season of Billions up. So they were, you know, up to their ass in alligators, just trying to get it all done and coming out of COVID. And he said, "This is really good. You want to get on a Zoom, you know?" And I did with him and his partner. And we talked about it a couple of different times, a couple of different Zoom meetings. And he just finally told me, he said, "Do not let your agent pitch this as a treatment. You need to write the pilot or it will get taken away from you."
Right.
So just go through the process of writing the pilot and then show it to me. So I'm, you know, and he's just helping me do it. He gave me a free copy of Final Draft, and I'm about halfway through it. And it's about, it's a time travel thing set in Marfa, Texas. It's called Marfa Lights.
Huh.
And it's, you know, sort of based on the idea that if a time traveler or an alien showed up in Marfa, it would take people a while to notice. That's one premise of it.
I've never been there, but you know, there's festivals and music festival there, right?
I've got so many friends that are connected to it, kind of semi. Terry Allen's one of my oldest, dearest friends. And Terry, you know, people know him as, you know, kind of part of that West Texas songwriter thing. He wrote New Delhi Freight Train that Little Feat did. He's made those great records like Juarez. But his day job is he's a visual artist. He paints and draws, but mainly he does bronze sculpture for the last several decades. And he's really great. He went through a period where he and David Byrne were doing these collaborations that were big environmental sculptures that were wired for sound. And Byrne did most of the music, and Terry did the visual part. I started painting because of Terry, right? That's where I got out of jail. He and Guy Clark were best friends. And
oh, gotcha. Okay.
They used to have a duo called, you know, well, all those guys, Joe Ely, all the West Texas guys, Ely, Butch Hancock, all those guys, they all went to the same high school. Terry was older than them, and he went away to LA to go to art school when he graduated.
Yeah. And the rest of them.
And came back and forth. And he was a big influence on those guys. He's sort of the ringleader of that whole West Texas school.
How about Jerry Jeff Walker? Maybe we should switch over, because I only have a peripheral, you know, exposure to his stuff. And you said you have a new project in the works.
Yeah. And one of the things I want to do is I've already recorded the Guy Clark songs, which are some of the songs he's best known for, because he put Guy on the map, because over two albums, he recorded three Guy Clark songs that are the best known Guy songs. But a lot of people associate them with Jerry Jeff. Desperado's Waiting for a Train, L.A. Freeway, and Old Time Feeling. And I've already recorded those songs because I did a record of Guy songs, you know, a while back.
Right.
So those aren't going to, I decided that since those are out of the way, I'll concentrate on songs that Jerry Jeff wrote. And there's lots of stuff that go back to 1968. I mean, I'm obviously doing Mr. Bojangles. I'm doing a song called I Makes Money, But It Don't Make Me, which is him and Dave Bromberg, you know, were a great duo. And it's, you know, he was a folky. He was like part of that second wave in the late 60s. He was kind of Keith Sykes, Emmylou Harris, Gary B. White, a bunch of folks lived over here on Thompson Street, about two blocks from where I am right now. And he was part of the National Coffee House circuit, and he was successful in that. And he's the reason that we know who Jimmy Buffett is. Buffett was from Alabama, and he was writing for Billboard in Nashville, and he interviewed Jerry Jeff, and which started a chain of events that ended up his wife kicking him out. So he came down to Florida to play a gig after Jerry Jeff went down to Coconut Grove, and he was a week early for his own gig, so he called Jerry Jeff. And Jerry Jeff drove him to Key West, and Buffett stayed. And that's how the whole Buffett Florida Caribbean thing got started. That's Jerry Jeff's fault too. He was hugely influential. I was lucky that I knew him before I even got to Nashville, and he would champion people. He would tell, you know, he's the reason we know about a lot of people. We did a memorial for him in Luckenbach. you know, Susan did get to have a funeral when he passed away because it was in the middle of all everything being locked down.
Yeah.
But me, Emmy, Buffett, Jeff Hanna, because the Dirt Man had the big hit on Mr. Bojangles. And there was a lot of folks on the thing. And you know, Pat Green and of course, Jerry Jeff's son, Django. And we sang a bunch of Jerry Jeff Walker songs in Luckenbach. So we're going to record it in December. I think you'll hear some songs you've never heard before if you don't know those early records, the Atco records and the Vanguard records. Those were
Yeah, I don't. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
There's some really good ones in there, and we got some. We're recording some of the other stuff, and there's going to be some, like, the main part of the record, which will be 10 songs. I've gone back to 10 songs because I make my records for vinyl because it's such a small thing that...
Yeah, you know, I'm starting to think the same way.
I sequence them and write them for vinyl. And if I have to have bonus tracks, I make those separately. I'll save one for Record Store Day because I like to support that. I like to have a single for Record Store Day every year. So we're probably going to record three other songs that he's known for that he didn't necessarily write. One of them is just, I think, is a great song that I learned from him, which is called Night Rider's Lament. It's on a record called Riding High that's after all those... Viva Trilingua and all those records that kind of put him on the map for good in the 70s. But a guy from Alaska showed up named Mike Burton, showed up in Austin and played around town for a couple of years and then decided he didn't like the lower 48 all that much. He went back to Alaska and I never heard from him again. But he wrote this incredible song called Night Rider's Lament. And actually, a lot of people think Chris LeDoux wrote it because LeDoux learned it from the Jerry Jeff record and he recorded it. And that whole cowboy music world, you know, out west where there's you know rodeos and literally it's cowboy
real cowboy stuff.
Listening to this stuff, they know the song is a Chris LeDoux record, so I'm going to record that, I think, for a bonus track. And I think just because I love Ray Hubbard so much, and people will expect it as a bonus track, we'll probably do Redneck Mother, although I'm a little conflicted about it. For one thing, you know, Ray Hubbard's so much more than that. He plays it every night. He's grateful for it, but he's
right.
Ray Hubbard's a great fucking performer and writes great songs. And but so I'm going to come up with a new MOTHER I've been working on that'll make it worth the trip and worth the price of admission. I'll just leave it at that. And I think, you know, we'll see what happens, but it's going to be called Jerry Jeff, and we're going to record it in December. It should be out in time for us to sell them off the stage when we hit the... I only do 3 months, you know, now. I do the cruise and a few gigs here and there, but as far as actually touring, I go from Memorial Day to Labor Day just so I can keep John Henry in school here for 9 months.
Sure. We're just kind of been on standby. You know, we've done a couple shows the last couple of months, or a couple months worth of shows, but with the pandemic, everything just kind of gets pushed back. So we're just kind of waiting for next year, and hopefully
we carried over shows from the summer before and last summer that, like, we had some that we couldn't. We didn't get started until July 1st last summer, so that meant we didn't get west of the Rockies. So we want to make sure we do that. I'm not going to get to Europe. I'm used to seeing Paris every 18 or 19 months, man. And I'm starting to freak out a little bit about that.
They're not ready to do anything yet.
And when they get ready to, summer, we're trying to plan really hard for a European tour summer after this coming one.
All right.
We're concentrating on making sure we get to, we'll play in the East. With 3 months, we should be able to do the whole country. Canada's a big deal for me, too. I have to play a few more shows in Canada than a lot of people do. Because that's the one place I ever played arenas was Canada. I played hockey rinks there in the 80s. So,
all right.
It's one of those. I think the Canadians like songs. They always have. Singer songwriters do well there. I think it's kind of always been there. And so, you got a record that's come out, or been working on another record? What's going on with that?
It came out in July. It's called Electro Melodier. And it's, you know, it's something that we put together during the pandemic, you know, so we were able to kind of focus on it more than normal because usually we're just kind of fitting recording in between gigs, but this time, you know, no gigs. So I think it has a different flavor, different elements, just being able to concentrate on the recording.
Yeah.
So looking forward to, you know, getting out and playing more shows in 2022. And I guess, you know, maybe you and I will meet up in Europe in 2022, Steve. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should try to get together and do something on purpose at some point. We should
share harmonicas, you know, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, share harmonicas and not, it's one of those. It's like, I know that's now that I think about that, that's pretty fucking intimate when you get right down to it. Well, it's been a blast. It's good to see you, man.
Yeah. Likewise. Been good talking, catching up.
It's a small world when you do this for a living. And it's one of those things, and not to hurt anybody else's feelings, just like when I spent about 30 seconds on the No Depression thing, you know, on that message board until I figured out it was a waste of time. And there were only about, you know, that there are about 300 nerds on there. And then, that, you know,
damn, you actually went there. That's impressive.
Yeah, I did go, but no, it would have been hard for you. Cause I figured out it was about was who's, you know, it was all like,
gotcha.
Postmortem stuff with your band, you know? So it was about who was cuter. And I always thought you were cuter anyway. So it's one of those things. It was never a question for me.
I'll take that to the grave.
I was an unapologetic Sunbolt guy, and I think everybody knows that. So it's good to see you, man.
Thanks, Steve. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
See ya. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse podcast, and thanks to Jay Farrar and Steve Earle for chatting. If you liked what you heard, please follow Talkhouse on all your favorite podcasting services and social media channels. This week's episode was produced by Melissa Kaplan, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.